So, welcome everybody to the Sunday sermon at Charter Grove. But I don't know if you ever remember going to sermons and teachings. Sometimes they were so boring. Even in our Buddhist groups, they were so boring. And you get these amazing teachers. This was when I was at college. Some really amazing teachers. And they wrote amazing books. But they couldn't give a talk for their life. And I remember telling one of my mates, Bernard, he was a professor of theoretical physics. I said, oh, I used to go to sleep during those talks. And he said, you were lucky, because I had to introduce the speakers. And I went to sleep too. But one thing of that experience, whenever something like that happens to you, you always learn from it. So instead of just giving up Buddhism or just saying, I never want to give public talks, you make sure the talks are useful, interesting. You know, a few stories, a few jokes, make them just more able to relate to people's experience. I always remember to do that. So if I sometimes forget, it's not that I'm not trying. You really try and make things nice and interesting. And also not go on for too long. Even interesting talks, which are very funny and very informative. Sometimes there are other things which are important in your life as well, like going to the toilet at 9 o'clock. So sometimes it's important just to, when you're talking, you're not just giving a talk, you're talking with people, not at people. And for today, the simile which is going to be the heart of this talk this morning, I don't plan them, except actually I did plan this talk on the way from my hut to here. So what can I talk about today? And from the questions and talking to a few of you, to give a little bit more structure to what you're doing in meditating, so you have some idea of what to do, but more likely what not to do, and to actually to see what happens as you meditate, but not sacrificing the path, because when you start talking about stages of meditation, some of the stages of meditation, you go, wow, these are amazing. Wow, you start talking about jhanas or nimittas, and say, wow. You know what happens next? I want, I want, I want. And so why not, in the sense that, you know, these things are available, lay people can do these things. And when I started talking about these deep states of meditation, I got criticized by other monks. And, you know, we don't all just do the same thing. That's one of the nice things about being a monastic. We can argue with one another, discuss, not in a sort of a negative way, but a way which we can make sure that all of us increase our performance. And so when I started teaching these deep meditations to lay people, oh, I said, no, you can't do that. I said, why not? Oh, it's too much trouble. Didn't seem right to me that just because you're a monk you can do these things, or a nun you can do these things, but lay people it's somehow banned. And this is true. For many years, because I go around, at least I used to before COVID, I go around to many different countries and get to know other monks and get respected by them, that I was that story when I was in Vietnam. In Vietnam, I'm very well respected, very well known by the monks there. So much so that I was at a conference in Vietnam, in Hanoi, Buddhist conference. And when I was there, you know, you have what you present, you know, your presentation when you're on the stage. But other times, you like to listen to what other people talk about. So I go in the back row somewhere and listen to others giving their talks. And I remember with great, you may call it pride and Ajahn Brahm being egotistical again, but it's not that, it was just funny. I was sitting in the back, and another monk came up to me, sat next to me, and while we were waiting for the next presentation, he said, oh, where are you from? He wanted to practice his English, which many monks in Asia love to do. So he's practicing his English. Oh, where are you from? He asked me. I said, I'm from Australia. He said, oh, you're from Australia. I said, yeah, from Australia. He said, do you know a famous monk called Ajahn Brahm? That's what he said. Because he never expected me to be sitting in the back. It was up in the front somewhere. And I said, I am Ajahn Brahm. Ah! He said. And he did actually go, ah! He was shocked. But anyway, I enjoyed that. But that's just making sure that you know that I've got lots of contacts in Vietnam. And they told me that for many, many, many years they had a decision not to teach the deep meditation to lay people, the jhanas. When they say something like that to me, my character is, I'm going to teach more to lay people, to be a bit rebellious. And why not? I said it because it was a little bit too troublesome for them. One of the troubles is, you've got to take that trouble, but you can deal with it. One of the troubles is that because it's there and you can do it, it's achievable, lay people do it, sometimes there's a lot of desire comes up. Say desire, but this is really quite big desire. I want to be enlightened. I want to get deep meditation. Why not? It's possible. I want. And of course, it's that wanting. It causes a problem. I did notice, I'm not sure who does all the messages on the board, but this morning as I went past, I was laughing to myself. The only message which was on there is a quote by this other monk, Ajahn Donut, whoever that is. And if you ask me, who is Ajahn Donut? And I say, I am Ajahn Donut. Ah! You know why they call me Ajahn Donut? This was over in Singaporeans, I think. I couldn't have been Indonesia. One of those two, anyway. They said, we'll call you Ajahn Donut for three reasons. First of all, you're very sweet. Very nice, Mark. Just like donut. Number two, you're out. And the nice thing at the end, it said, and you're holy, just like a donut. Sweet, round and holy. So I qualify as being Ajahn Donut. But anyway, the quote was, and it's a wonderful quote, when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. And that's almost like Four Noble Truths. But very briefly, without any sort of deeper explanation, you want something more. You can't enjoy this moment. You may have, and this has happened to me before, so it happens to many people, you're in a nimitta. And nimitta's incredible states of mind, beautiful, happy, joyful, or you're having a great time. But I want something more. I want the next stage. And that destroys your nimitta. Because it's a wanting. Just relax. Take it easy. It happens by itself. Stop you wanting and disturbing the whole process. So that's a very important statement. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. Sometimes when people are eating your breakfast or your lunch, you're not really eating what's in your mouth. You're already moving things around for what you would need next on your plate. Not in the present moment. Not enjoying the mouthful of food which is in your mouth right now. And that's one of the reasons why people have bad digestion. They never taste their food. How many of you had a good meditation, and you had a baked bean, and you put it in your mouth and go, wow, this is amazing, that story I told. You enjoy your food much more when you're eating it. Instead of talking with friends, or thinking what you're going to do next, or just planning what you're going to put in your mouth, two or three spoons ahead of yourself. Because when you're really with the food you're eating, tasting it, enjoying it, all these stuff gets secreted into your system, even like saliva, which is an obvious thing, and it digests the food. It's because I'm mindful of when I'm eating, and because I know about this, that I don't eat that much. But most of it's digested. That's for you, it just goes straight out. Which is why we've got problems with blockage of the toilets, apparently. That's why I was a bit late coming in here today. It's true. caretaker Scotty just told me, oh, there's blockage in the toilets, what's going on? So I had to teach you to digest more of the food you put in your mouth, so less of it will go to blocking the toilets. Anyway, coming back to being serious, if I can, which is very difficult, but never miss, I'll try. The story which tries to bring all this together so you can know what you're doing, you know where it leads, how beautiful it is, the more of you have an opportunity to experience these states. I never said to achieve them, I said to experience them. Chose my word very carefully there. If it's a personal achievement, you're having big trouble. If it's experiencing them, possible. You can't achieve them. You can experience them. You know what the difference is? Okay, I usually don't say this until towards the end of the retreat, but let's get this out of the way. You know, I've written so many books about deep meditations, about nimittas and jhanas, and given many lectures about them. And eventually, I mean, I tried to just push it aside, not making a personal thing, but eventually when I was giving a talk in Sri Lanka, in the south of Sri Lanka somewhere, the Forest Monastery, there's all monks there, and the monks were recording sort of my talk. When it came to question time, the monks never pulled any punches. You know, it's monk to monk, so they just asked me directly, Ajahn Brahm, you're well known for teaching jhanas. Ajahn Brahm, can you achieve those jhanas? They asked me directly, what should I do? Because as a monk, you're not allowed to tell lay people any of your deep attainments. And if you lie about it, that's a disrobable offence. It's very, very sensitive in the Buddhist Sangha about these things. And it protects a lot of monks, but it's also quite frustrating sometimes. So I decided, on camera, in front of all these monks in Sri Lanka, to tell the truth. You interested? I saw you all go quiet and really listening for a change. Oh, wow. And I said to them, staring the camera in the eye, and I said, Ajahn Brahm cannot enter jhana. And they were quiet like you. They were looking. Is this a fraud? The way I said it didn't really feel like I was being fraudulent or cheating or anything. But I said it, Ajahn Brahm can't enter jhanas. And they paused. And I said, Ajahn Brahm has to disappear first. I have to vanish. I have to go, bye-bye, Ajahn Brahm. Then jhanas happen. It's a bit of a loophole, you know, because I can't claim to achieve anything. That's against my rules. Especially, you know, there's only two monks here. What I can do, though, is to give a really beautiful teaching. It doesn't become an attainment anymore. You have to vanish. If you do it, you find you can't. But if you vanish your sense of self, your ownership of the process of meditation, if that starts to disappear, then those jhanas become easy. Well, that's a really powerful teaching. So I mentioned yesterday when somebody gave the wonderful question, is desire the root of suffering? I said, no, there's something behind desire, where desire comes from, and the illusion of a sense of self. Where there's a me, there's always been desire. When me disappears, so does desire. And you get these wonderful deep states of peace and meditation. So anyway, the story, the simile, which is the most helpful which I've ever devised. Some of you, again, have heard this before, but there's always a little change somewhere in these similes. So please listen. Don't think, oh, God, how many times do I have to hear this one? You have to keep... That's why somebody asked me years ago, why do Ajahn Brahm, it said, why do you keep telling the same stories and giving the same answers to the questions? Why do you keep saying the same things? I said, because you keep asking the same questions. And that was a fair answer. So anyway, So it's a simile of the thousand-petal lotus. And I love this simile because I can really get into it. And it's also helpful. And it shows you exactly what you should be doing and not doing in meditation, and what happens and why it happens. So, you know, the lotus, we've got one lotus there. I've got a few lotuses. Do you call them loti or lotuses? It's amazing, isn't it? People can have arguments over stupid things instead of listening to the simile. So, the simile of the thousand-petal lotus's eye, or whatever it was, is lotus, very common simile in Buddhism. And the thousand-petal lotus is a lotus closes up at nighttime. And if ever you manage to see, there's one closed lotus in the back, there's only plastic lotuses, not the real thing, but nevertheless, you know they're all closed up at nighttime. And when the sun rises in the morning, when the first light and warmth of the sun hits the outermost petals of that lotus, it starts to open up. And the outermost petal of all lotuses are always rough, sometimes serrated like corrugated iron, and not all that beautiful, and there's certainly no fragrance to it. You go and sniff a closed lotus, you can't even smell anything. And unless you knew what you were sniffing, you would never believe what's inside that lotus and how beautiful and fragrant it is inside. But how does that lotus open up? And you can see the first part of this simile. You are that lotus. Sometimes when you come here, all closed up, corrugated, nothing at all. Sometimes who would ever think that inside there there's this beautiful jhanas and all sorts of other amazing things inside? And again, I can't help telling the story that, you know, sometimes I get really stupid sometimes. And on one of these retreats about 4 or 5 years ago now, I was here early, and I was just around the reception area because I had a little office in there. And this guy came in, he wanted to check in, and I took one look at him. He was this big Aussie guy with, I think, a T-shirt and shorts, this Australian national dress, and he had tattoos all over him. He looked really, you know, he's about his mid-20s or early 30s, just really sort of rough. And I also know, as you know, that just up the road from here is a prison farm. And I said, I'm stupid, Ajahn Brahm, I think you've gone to the wrong place. The prison's up the top. You should never judge people, but sometimes you just do it. But I'm glad I did, because it gave me a nice story. So he said, no, I'm on the list. And he told his name. He was on there. Yeah, fair enough. Okay, well, all sorts. So this big Aussie guy, I'd never seen before, and really full of tattoos all over him, looked really rough. When it came to the interview times, we have our first interviews today, then he came to an interview and he said, I had a nice deep experience of meditation. I said, yeah, what was it? And he started to recount what had happened to him. And I was blown away, because what he was describing was the first jhana. And those of you who come up to me and said you had this experience, that experience, you know that I'm one of the toughest judges when it comes to your meditation experiences. You know, to get me say, yeah, that was a jhana, you have to really have some very deep experiences. And he was one. He said, yeah, that was it. Well done. And it surprised me so much. He was the last person in the retreat I ever thought would get jhanas. And he did it. And that just taught me another lesson. You cannot judge people. And to say, though, it's a troublesome if people get jhana, no. He just vanished. He disappears. And his tattoos and his body and stuff were all gone when he got into these states. And his personality, who he thought he was, also vanished for that while. So these are those deep experiences where you vanish and your desire vanishes with you. And it just happens. There's many, many people say that they didn't do it. It just happened, they disappeared, vanished. And that's what happens. So anyway, back to the lotus. Even the most unlikely lotuses, when they're closed, inside have the most beautiful petals. So how do you get to those beautiful petals? The warmth and light of the sun opens the lotus by itself. The warmth and light of the sun, the light stands for good old mindfulness, being aware. Whatever you're aware of, whatever petal, that's the most important petal in the whole world. You don't think of the petals right in the center over there, which haven't opened up yet. The petal where you are, that's the most important thing in the whole world. Be mindful of it. Fully aware. Not just half aware. Half aware of where I am and half aware of where I want to go to. Now, where you are. And the warmth of the sun. Kindness. Care. How many times do you have to stress the importance of kindness, compassion, love, whatever you wish to call it. Metta is the best word. Loving kindness. That is so essential. So you have it all parts of the meditation. And the idea of the warmth of the sun as well as the light of the sun brings out the importance, the equal importance of kindness with mindfulness. As many of you know, just trying to be a skillful teacher, you create new words, and that's where we created the new word. I remember creating this in Hong Kong, talking with another gentleman about this, and saying, well, let's call it kindfulness. Mindfulness and kindness, put it together, and it becomes kindfulness, which is so much more powerful than mindfulness alone, so much more powerful than compassion or kindness alone. Kindfulness, it's a wonderful word. And anyway, so that's what the sun is. It gives warmth and light to the petal of the lotus, and that opens up. And because the outermost sheath, you can't really call it a petal, the outermost sheath opens up, that allows the light and warmth of the sun to fall on the next layer of petals, the first and the real layer of petals. So they can soak up the light and the warmth of the sun, and that too opens up. And then you've got petal layer number two. So that can be warm to have the light of the sun, the kindness and the warmth, and that opens up. They open up one after the other, one after the other, one after the other. Now you don't go on to the next lotus. It's the same old lotus, your body and mind, who bears your name. You recognize in the morning when you look in the mirror and go, oh my goodness, what do I look like today? Because you haven't had as much sleep as you normally have. So that is your lotus. Give it kindness. Give it attention. And it opens up. So, how does your lotus open up? First of all, when you meditate, you sit down on a seat, on a cushion or wherever. And all these cushions we have, you know, just... and maybe because of COVID or something, but meditation was getting so popular that, you know, we, about time we had like meditation cushion technology. Just have these old cushions that, these have been the same for 20, 30 years, these zafus. Surely we can do better than this. So imagine what you can do. You can have like little compartments in the zafu and a little automatic remote control. And so if you're, you know, your bottom is too low, you can press a button in the remote control and the back part fills with air and raises up a little bit. If, you know, you need your leg moved up a bit because it's got a bit of pain, that can move up a bit as well. You can press another button, it gives a massage in case you're getting sore. If you're too cold, you can heat it up a bit, but if it gets too hot, you can cool it down again. Have you ever been in those toilets in Japan and Korea? You know, the same sort of ideas, but you know, just for meditation cushion. And for those of you who always have trouble with sloth and torpor, another little button, and there's a little cup next to you, and you get a cup of coffee from your zafu. Don't overcome sloth and torpor.
I'm really surprised people haven't thought of that sort of rubbish stuff. Especially in California, where people meditate a lot. There's a lot of bucks to be made there. If I wasn't a monk, I'd be a billionaire. Developer of meditation cushions, but that's a bit fraudulent. But anyway, back to... So you open up your body, first of all. Try and make it comfortable. So I keep on saying. How do you make your body comfortable? You're aware of it. Mindfulness. And you're kind to it. Don't try and overcome your body with the power of your will. Say, right, I'm going to sit here. Yeah, it's a bit achy and painy, but even though my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust, I will not move from this spot until Ajahn Brahm finishes his talk. Don't try that sort of stuff. Instead, be kind to your body. And you know, it's for a long time. You know, I've taught people that if you get your body correct at the beginning, it can be very peaceful for a long time. But if it so happens, you meditate after half an hour, 40 minutes, your mind is getting peaceful, your body is aching, move. It only takes 30 seconds. You know, you just, your eyes are closed and maybe your legs are hurting, so you move your foot. There, that's better. That took about 20 seconds. Of course, I lost a bit of peace, but the peace which I've lost, I can make up in 1 or 2 minutes. So after about 2 or 3 minutes, I'm back to where I started, but without the pain now. So I can go much deeper in meditation afterwards. That is, you know, that how we are sensible, we're kind to our body. We don't think, nah, I'm not going to move. Real meditators don't move. They do. And so I do that sometimes. And remember this great meditator, Ajahn Pliyan. He only just died last year. Last year? Yeah, about 2 years ago. But anyway, I was reading one of his books, and he's a very good meditation teacher, and he said exactly the same. If it's really hurting, then just move a bit. If it's a small itch or something, leave it alone. It won't hurt you. But if it's a real ache or pain, just move, and then you can meditate for much longer. So the mindfulness and kindness with your body. So you scan your body when you start meditating, find out how it feels. And if it's tight somewhere, do something about it. Even just looking at a part of your body which is aching, which is sore, and just giving it kindness relaxes it. Because you know, if you're really tight and tense, afraid, then the body whole tightens up and that creates a lot of pain after a while. Instead, just relax. When you know how to relax your body, and how do you learn how to relax your body? You're mindful of it, trial and error, and so you can relax it very easily. Okay. One of the great stories, one of the monks' monastery many years ago had a bad back, not me, another monk, had a very bad back. Every time he meditated, after half an hour, got into great pain. So he went to see the doctor, they gave him a scan, and they found he had a genetic defect of his spine. And the doctor said, best thing to do is don't meditate. I'm a monk! So what to do next? And so the doctor basically gave up on him. But he got a nice little book, and he found this really wise method of actually healing himself. And the book said, on your spine, on either side of the spine, there are muscles which most of us, we don't know about because we don't use. They're there, but we have no awareness of them. So, the book replied, every morning for 15 minutes, take your hand and show exactly where they were and just stroke those muscles for 15 minutes on either side, every morning. And he did that because he was actually stroking those muscles every morning. He's actually creating the neural connection to those muscles. And after a month or 2 months, he could actually feel those muscles without stroking them, became aware of them. And number two, the next thing, is learn how to move those muscles, to stretch them, to relax them. How do you do that? Trial and error. You know, try this, try that, try something else, until he could feel the move.
just the way that a kid learns how to walk, you know, or learns how to lift things up. Sometimes they drop them because they're learning by trial and error. And so after another couple of months, he could actually move those muscles up and down, up and down. So the next thing to do, 50 minutes every morning, exercise those muscles, stretch them up, stretch them down on both sides of the spine. It's, you know, I can't do that because I don't know where those muscles are. I'm not aware of them, don't have to be. But he could do that, and he can move his muscles up and down on either side of his spine, which hardly anyone else can ever do, until they became so strong through exercise that they totally compensated for the weakness in his spine. And he can meditate. Problem solved. It's a very beautiful little story. It happened in Bodhinyana Monastery many years ago, which just shows there's so much of your body which you don't know, and yet you can move it up and down just by being aware of it, being kind to it, and learning how it works. So that's actually what you can do with, I always say, the muscles around my eyes and my mouth. You know them so well, you can just move them and relax them. And relax the muscles around my tummy, having had a nice breakfast. Muscles in my shoulders, muscles in my leg. You can relax so much. You're aware of all those muscles, and you've learned how to loosen them all. When you loosen those muscles, it's again great for your health. One of the reasons, the similes, which I love giving, is the simile of a guitar string. Guitar strings stretch tight, and something hits it. Bing! It makes a loud noise, which is quite disturbing. You loosen the tension of the guitar string, something hits it, boom. It's got a low pitch, and also it's not so disturbing. And when it's totally loose, something hits it, nothing hits it, nothing hits it, doesn't make any sound at all. It's my little simile on what resilience is. You get hit by many things in life and in meditation. If you're so tense and tight, oh, it just makes a noise, it's going to really disturb you. If you're so loose, something happens, they bang the door. It doesn't affect your smile at all. Because you're loose. No tightness, no tension, no stress inside. So you learn how to really relax your body. And that's just the first opening of the lotus, until your body gets very nice, comfortable, at ease. And then, when it's at ease, it's not so causing any problems. It doesn't want anything. It doesn't. When your family are happy at home, when you're off on retreat, they don't ring you up or email you, Mummy, where's the condensed, no, where's the, I was going to say condensed milk, shows what I'm thinking about. No, where's the milk? Where's the eggs? But when everything is nicely sorted out, you know, then you know, they leave you alone. So when your body's nice and happy, it leaves your mind alone. So basically, the body disappears. You still sort of feel it, but it's on the outside. It's not a problem anymore. It's just there in the background instead of being in the front of your attention. So then you go inside your mind. It's the next layer of petals inside the body is your mind. That's how it feels, and that's a good way to look at it. Now, physically, it's not in your body anywhere, because people ask, where in the body? Is it in my head? Is it in my heart? Is it in my toes? Where does your mind live? If you want to, okay, I'm conscious of the time. If you want to know where your mind is, you want to find out where it is? It's a very good little exercise. You can do this exercise with your friends, or some of you teach meditation to someone or other. Be honest right now. If you're happy, more happy than sad, put up your right hand. If you're more sad than happy, put up your left hand. Be honest. Okay. Anyone with the left hand up? Ah, oh, now keep it up. Just say, now with your index finger, say you're, those with your right hand up, you're more happy than sad. Please point to the happiness for me. Where is it? Come on, where is it? Were you just imagining the happiness? It was real. Where is it? And you can't, some say in the head,
sometimes in the toes, I don't know where they put it, sometimes in the tummy if you just had a nice breakfast. But of course, the happiness doesn't live in the body. Next time you're angry, really angry and upset at somebody, point to the anger. Don't point out the person who caused the anger. That's not anger, that's the cause of anger. In your body, where is it? In your head, you reckon? So if I cut your head off, you wouldn't get angry? That's true, actually. It's not in your head. Your head's not angry. Because sometimes... Okay, let's make it even more clear. If you are in love, you've just fallen in love. Ah, where's that love? You can't point to the source of emotions because they're not in the body. The mind is not in the body. The body is in the mind. Shall I prove it to you? Okay, it's an old simile, but it's a good one. This was from a 5-year-old girl. First year primary school in UK. It's the daughter of one of my friends. The question in class, if you haven't heard this one before, what's the biggest thing in the world? You know, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds in school, they keep putting their hands up so quickly. So they put their hand up, Madam, my daddy is the most biggest thing in the world. No, 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 miss, an elephant is the biggest thing in the world. No, 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 a mountain is the biggest thing in the world. And the daughter of my friend, she put her hand up and said, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. Everyone stopped, apparently. They went quiet. What the heck are you talking about? Your eye is the biggest thing in the world? And this 5-6-year-old genius, who eventually did PhD in Oxford, well, she was about 21, 22 when she did the PhD, not 6 or 7, by the way. But it was an answer of genius at the time. Well, she said, my eye can see her daddy, can see an elephant, can see a mountain, and can see so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. It's a great argument. Except your mind is bigger than that. Your mind can see everything your eye can ever see. And it can see things which you'll never see in the real world. Imaginary objects, fantasy objects. And it can hear real and imaginary sounds. It can smell, taste, touch. And has its own field of knowledge. Everything you can ever experience in this life and other lives, all of that can fit into your mind. It's pretty big. In fact, it's the biggest thing. Not in the world, because the world can be experienced. Therefore, it fits into your mind. Different way of looking, but a very wonderful argument. So, you know, that's why you can't really point to your mind. But anyway, in the meditation, I talk too much. In the meditation, you're going into your body and you go into your mind, which is why in those guided meditations I start teaching the peaceometer. I mentioned that the first night, peaceometer. Why did I mention that? Because it gives you some way of knowing an important part of your mind. How peaceful are you? How agitated are you? If you want, how tired are you? How energized are you in your mind? How happy are you? How sad? These are all ways of just getting you to get in contact with your mind. So you go inside to the mind. That becomes the next layer of petals. And of course, because of who we are and the way we live, the first thing we know is like this time petal, past and future, and the present moment, which is a tiny little bit in the center. And we, from the body, when that disappears, we become aware of the temporal mind with past and future. So what do we do to get into the present moment? We're aware and we're kind.
Wonderful, opening the door of your heart to this, whatever's happening. And so you're wandering off into the future, as I said yesterday. Just follow your mind. Go into the future with it. What do you mean the future? Because as long as you're there and you're being aware of what's happening right now, what is this future? So you're with it all the time. What is travel? When you don't do any moving, the car, the bus, or the aircraft doesn't move. You just do the being in the moment. So little by little, with kindness and awareness. The kindness is so important because so often people get critical of themselves. I'm wandering off into the future again. Why do I keep thinking about this stupid past? Let go. Every time you say to yourself, give yourself an order, let go, you're not letting go at all. You're doing completely the opposite. Come on, let go. That's not letting go. So instead, we are just kind to this moment, mindful of what's happening, not judging. And then we're kind and mindful, then time, just the petal of time opens up. You get a present moment. It's right in the middle of time. You don't do it. It's just, you notice after a while, this past and future just are basically vanishing. They're not important to you anymore. They're just mostly gone. You're in this moment, and you're kind to this moment, and aware of it, whatever it is. Sometimes when I come to the present moment, it's tiredness, or an ache, or a pain, or something. I'm not sort of full energy yet. Oh, it's okay. You get used to that. You don't judge. You're kind to this moment. Ah, oh, poor Ajahn Brown. He has to work so hard. He never gets a rest. Poor Ajahn Brown. People are asking questions, which he's answered so many times before. People never learn. Oh, poor Ajahn Brown. I'm kind to myself. I tell a bad joke or mess up the punchline. Actually, that reminds me of, you know, that when the your children go to proms again, the school proms. There's this guy, you know, he invited out his girlfriend to the school prom, and she accepted. So he had to go and get some tickets. So he had to go to the school office there, and he had to line up. It was a long queue to get tickets for the school prom. He managed to get those tickets. Then he had to get, you know, the formal suit. He went to the, you know, the suit hire place, another long queue for the suit. And then he had to get the flowers, another long queue. And the limousine to take him to the event, another long queue. And even just when he arrived at the venue with his girlfriend all dressed up, there was another long queue to get in because of security. And once they were in the hall, he asked his girlfriend what she wants to drink. She said, oh, I'll have some of that punch. But there was no punchline. Okay. You have to think to get that joke. back to the present moment awareness. And when you're kind and you're mindful, just it opens up and you're in this moment. And straight away, when you're just getting to present moment awareness, there's so much more, but that is so beautiful. You stay in the present moment long enough, it's like you're free. You're free of all these things which you think you have to do and all the mistakes which you've done in the past. The past and the future are all gone. Ooh. When you really get into it properly, you're not holding it, you know, for fear of losing it, which is you haven't really got the present moment, you're worrying about the future when there's no present moment awareness for you. When you're really relaxed into it, it's a great abiding of peace and health. Love being in the moment. After a while, why is it, where on earth else do you want to be? Except here. Here is not a bad place. After a while, you get used to it. It gets used to you, and you have a lot of fun in the moment. So you come into this present moment. So you're in the present moment. But then you heard nimittas, jhanas. I want more. And of course, when you want something else, you can't enjoy what you already have. So to get to the next stage, you really have to start enjoying the present moment. So don't want anything. Stay there, just in this moment, just really getting into it, really blissing out on it, enjoying it to the max. And I keep saying relax to the max. It's not a joke. That's a very powerful statement. It's not half relaxing, not 80%, not 95%. It's 100% relaxing and easing off, being kind and being aware. Then you find the present moment awareness. It opens up all by itself. You know what's inside the present moment? Right in its center? Silence. You can't give anything a name. If I give something a name, I'm naming what just happened a moment or two ago. I've lost the present moment when I start thinking. And sometimes you ask yourself, what do you want to think about anyway? You're gaining experience. I was a theoretical physicist, but you were trained to do experiments as well. And in experiments, you were trained. You collect all the data, the information, the readings, but you don't think about what those readings mean until you've got all the data in. Otherwise, what happens? You get half the data in, oh, this is interesting. And you make a conclusion and you bend all the other data. Oh, that must be wrong data because it doesn't fit your conclusion. You tend to mess up your experiment. So just collect all the data first. Don't think about it. And then when it's all in, then you can do your thinking. It's at the end of the meditation, you do your contemplation. What happened? What was this? What worked? What didn't work? That is when you do the thinking, not in the middle of the meditation. So you go in the present moment, and deep in the present moment is silence. Literally, you have no time to think. You can't give things names. Things are much more profound than any name can capture. You have so many experiences in meditation. It was good that I learned another language, not another European language, but like Thai. Because Thai is a different way of thinking. There's some concepts in there which just you cannot translate into English. There's some English concepts you can't translate into Thai. So, you know, sometimes you have to almost switch a huge perceptive change in your brain to be able to speak in real Thai. And that was useful for me because it realized just how many words, actually most languages, they don't capture the majority of experiences in life. They get by so we can socialize and get some things done. When it comes to really important things, the language is insufficient. And it's nice to know you don't need to have words for these things, to really enjoy them and appreciate them and know them. So you know this present moment in silence. And as it's opened up, a beautiful petal of lotuses come in, just the silent in the middle of the present moment, in the middle of time, in the middle of your body. You're always going in to the next stage of meditation, going in. You never go on to the next stage of meditation. I found that idea so helpful because I don't have to, what's next? That's the wrong question. What's inside where you already are? So you don't go anywhere, you stay where you are and you tend to fall inwards. As I was saying, from the body into the mind, into time and then to present moment, then into silence. And then after silence, when silence petal, it's very beautiful, that opens up. When that opens up, you know what you're aware of, you're aware of your breathing. And the only reason you say that is because that's the only thing left moving. Your heart is moving, but you know, if your body goes off to the heartbeat, that becomes a little bit problematical. Just nearly all the time, people become aware of their breath. And don't choose the breath. I don't choose to watch my breath, ever. Instead, it just comes up by itself. And what that means is, by that time, it's very peaceful, very beautiful. Because I've opened up all these outermost petals, and inside is the petal of the breath. I know that sometimes people, when they learn meditation, they know all these stages, and it's a characteristic of our modern world. We're impatient. And we think, oh my goodness, it's only 8 days to go. Ah, not enough. Was it 7 days? I don't know. Ah. And they want to rush. I tell people, please, this is only the second day or third day of the retreat. I don't know, whatever it is. Anyway, it's still early days yet on this retreat. Please don't get enlightened today. If you get enlightened today, what are you going to do for the rest of the week? So slow down. So you get into the breath just happens. And for those of you, you know, who have been trained by lay people like I was when I first started meditating, you know, go to the breath straight away, just hold it, it'll soon settle down. You sort of can do that, but it's much better just to do the thousand petal lotus thing, just allow it to open up naturally when it's ready, because then when the breath comes in, it's already really gorgeous. The petals are beautiful and they're so fragrant. Just watching the breath come in and go out. Easy. Even in the Anapanasati Sutta. Again, this was one of those translations which, you know, when I first saw it, thought, can't be right. And after many years of meditating and knowing my mind and knowing other people's minds and knowing Pali much better, where it says to establish mindfulness in front of you, that's a very bad translation. It doesn't mean in front of you. It's one of these idioms. It's make it a priority, mindfulness first. It's not locating it in space, because mindfulness is not located in space. It's the very beginning of the meditation. Find a nice quiet place, you sit down comfortably, you make mindfulness the most important thing. Get mindfulness really strong. So, awareness and kindness. So you really are very, very aware. And then you can see your breath so easily. And you don't have to hold it. It's not forced or fate. It's natural. A beautiful natural process. So you can see your breath going in, going out. And it's no effort, because it's beautiful. You ever notice anything which is gorgeous and beautiful, like seeing a sunset, seeing a beautiful flowers? You know, you don't look at it. It draws your attention to it. That's what your breath does. It draws your attention, your mindfulness to it, because it's very nice, very peaceful. So you're just watching your breath go in and go out. And of course, inside that layer of petals, the next layer of petals is what they call the full awareness of the breath. From the very beginning of the in-breath to the end of the in-breath. You see the pause. There's always a pause when the in-breath has gone in. You don't need to breathe out yet. And then the out-breath goes. Stops backwards and forwards. And by this time, you should start to have what I call enhanced perception, enhanced awareness. So you see so much more of an in-breath. It's not just an in-breath. It's a crazy thing to say to most people, but in one in-breath, there's thousands of different feelings. Just from one in-breath, it's weird. And once you become really aware of your in-breath and your out-breath, there's no two in-breaths are ever the same. Totally different. And you can see all of that. It fascinates you. Just like when you do the walking meditation, which I'm supposed to say one time. After our walking meditation, you feel the feet moving up. And sometimes you get so into the walking meditation, you do it slowly because there's too much going on to do it fast. And you can feel just as the leg starts to move, all those muscles which need to sort of either relax or tense up just to lift your foot off the floor, and the way it goes up. And does it go up vertical? Does it go a little bit backwards? mind goes up a little bit of a curve. And then when it starts to move forward, it goes up a bit and then forward. It's never a straight line. There's always some curvature there. And you feel all the sensations. It becomes fascinating. And which means you've got the joy as well as the awareness. And you've got the happiness. The deeper you go into the lotus, the more beautiful and fragrant it is. It's captivating inside. You can smell its fragrance. Oh, that's delicious. And so you're just watching a breath, the full awareness of the breath. And you can see, as that starts to develop, the lotus petals open up, you get what we call the delightful breath. I used to call it the beautiful breath. I mentioned this the other day. Delightful breath is a better word for it. Delightful breath. You're breathing in. Oh, this is so nice. You've got joy with what you're doing. And that's where you can start watching your breath for long periods of time. And you're satisfied, content, just watching. And it's ridiculous in one sense. Yes, you can spend half an hour just watching your breath. You know, you really need to get a therapist. And of course, there's no therapist. That's what therapists teach other people to do. To be so mindful of what's happening. You can watch the breath for such a long time, so peaceful, so relaxed, enjoying. And that is, of course, what happens when, you can't fake this, when you're meditating before lunchtime, and you know it's lunchtime, you know you're watching the breath, and this is wonderful, and you just carry on watching your breath. Ah, forget about lunch. Because the breath, in this part of meditation, is more enjoyable. Quite a lot more enjoyable than having to go for lunch. That's a really good sign. It shows what's going on. Inside this lotus, you've got this beautiful layer of petals, the delightful breath. When you know what lunch is all about, it's no contest. You stay with the delightful breath. Mm. When you're delightful breath, that I always call the pivot point to meditation. You get the delightful breath, that's where you are. It's so wonderful. You don't have to do anything. Any last bit of effort or wanting or doing anything is crazy. Just stay there, enjoy. You say, well, what if I don't do anything? The delightful breath, that's all I'll get. Oh, come on. That's not how it works. If you're really content with the delightful breath, which should be pretty easy to do, there's no wanting. Your mind becomes so still, so happy just being here with the delightful breath. And the delight gets stronger. The breath gets weaker. The delight gets even stronger, and the breath is almost vanishing. And the delight conquers. Not the right word, I don't know another word, but it's bigger than the breath. So you see the joy, the piti sukha. And it's a mental, a citta sankhara. And that becomes the beautiful nimitta lands. In the nimittas you can hardly feel your bodies. It's mostly gone. Can hardly hear sound. If you do, it's 100 miles away. You'll hear someone call you. It's time for lunch. And for you, it's like they're 100 miles away. You just hear them. That's just what happens when your body's vanishing. And it's beautiful nimittas. What do you do with the nimitta layer of petals? Nothing. Just carry on being aware and being kind. That's all you ever do, especially in those deep stages of meditation. Please remember that. Don't do anything. It's really weird that people get in these deep states of meditation and do everything right up to there. They say, right, now, this is limitless at last. Now, this is what I've got to do. Ajahn Brahm said this, I read about this and do that. And you mess up at the end. The opening and the lotus petals, boom, 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 they all close again. So instead of doing that, just have a bit of confidence. Let it happen. You have to disappear now. You've got the delightful breath. There is no one doing this. It's just happening by yourself, with kindness, with awareness. And you get this beautiful nimittas come up. Should give a talk just about nimittas because they're really important. And then it gets so beautiful, so still, so amazing. And of course, they're just so delightful, amazing, wonderful. And of course you can't control them. They're much bigger than you. Which is one of the reasons why they're scary. You know how powerful these things are. You know you can't control them. You can try, but you just mess up. You just leave them alone. You don't do anything. You're vanishing. You're disappearing. And don't worry, you come back again afterwards. But having a great experience and understanding some of what this, some of these teachings like non-self are really all about. And anyway, the images get very powerful, very beautiful. You have a wonderful time. And sometimes people come up to me afterwards for the interview and say, was that a nimitta, Ajahn Brahm? And I have a look at you. And if you're not just like beautiful smiles and, Ajahn Brahm, it's okay, yeah. That probably was. These are emotional highs. You don't come out and say, Ajahn Brahm, I think that was a nimitta. Really cold, as if you know you just got a telephone call about, you know, an election somewhere. No, these are beautiful, powerful. They get right into you. You're going deep into your lotus, and the deeper you go, the more beautiful and fragrant. It's overpowering sometimes. And anyway, just leave it alone. It'll develop by itself. And then the nimitta petals open up. You go deep inside, and that's where the first jhana is. It's inside the nimitta. Inside the nimittas, that's where you find the jhanas. Inside the delightful breath, that's where you find the nimittas. Inside the ordinary breath, you find the delightful breath. Inside the silence of the present moment, that's where you find the breath. Inside the time, you find the silent present moment awareness. Inside of this body, you find your mind. Inside of this hall, you find all of these things. The deeper you go in, it opens naturally. So sometimes people have a common question, experience they have, is they get delightful breath, and sometimes the nimitta comes up, and they keep asking a stupid question. It's a natural question, but it's not a correct question to ask. He said, well, I can sort of see a nimitta, but I'm still aware of the delightful breath. Which one should I choose? You don't choose at all. What you experience in this moment is almost like a combination. Like the petal of the delightful breath is opening out. It's starting to see what's inside of it, a nimitta. Just let it happen naturally. Don't rush it. Don't choose. It doesn't matter how long that lasts. Be patient with it. And see what happens next. So don't do anything. Shh. Be calm and be peaceful. And the more you can let go, the better. I'll finish off with a statement from the first layperson who came up to me many, many, many years ago. He said, you can do these things. Came up to me and said that, you know, he had a jhana, and I asked him what had happened. And it was a jhana. But then I asked him the question, what did you do special this time that you got a jhana? Because he'd meditated before many times, but this, you know, he got the jhana. What did you do? And his answer was, I really let go. I really let go. And I took note of that. And then the second person who had a jhana, I asked him the same question. What did you do special? And he says, no exaggeration. They said exactly the same. I really let go. Third time, I never even bothered to ask. You really let go. Do you understand? No, you don't. But one day you will. Keep on going, you'll get there. Sadhu. 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 Okay, excellent. So we have interviews now, so please try and keep the time as best you possibly can. It has to be only 10 minutes each because there's quite a lot of people today. And if any of you want to, can't get on the interviews, you can always ask the questions on the piece of paper this evening.